activated a soul.
Once more under the breach, dear friend.
Else close the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting episode of The Personal Wealth Coach starring Jeff and...
Jake.
McClure. Yes, we did it.
We can say our names.
We successfully did our opening act, and now we don't have a clue what we're going to say. I am supposed to disclose, or he is, or both of us are supposed to take our clothes off at this point or something.
Disclose.
Yes. And we're supposed to say something to the effect that nothing that we say in this next 2 hours will have any relevance to anything whatsoever that you should do personally with your investments, which is to say is not investment advice, even though we are the principal advisors in an SEC-registered investment advisory firm in Salado, Texas, that has the same name as the radio program. So it's not a coincidence. And these two things, the radio program and our investment advisory business, just they're definitely affiliated. They may be an entangled pair.
Quantumly affiliated?
Well, I think they're an entangled pair. I don't think you can determine one is the other, except one of them is not investment advice. That's this one. It's education. And the other one, we do a lot of education, but we also give investment advice. So... That's weird, but you just got a disclosure that's somebody tried. I tried to say it in English, in plain English, where it could be understood,
right.
Which just confused everybody, I'm
yeah,
sure.
Yeah, plain English is weird.
Yeah, it is. Mountain English is even weirder. So, what happened during the week? And by the way, this is Saturday, January 21st and of 2017. And if you'd like to give us a call, 254 is the area code, and 773-1400 is the telephone number. And if it is Saturday, January 21st, 2017, where you are, you're welcome to give us a call, ask questions, make comments, anything about economics. Do not expect us to know anything about disorganized sports or organized sports, for that matter, because we don't. So let's see. During the week, the Standard & Poor's 500 Stock Index, which we tend to pay some degree of attention to, although we don't recommend you invest in it because technically you can't, was down 0.15% after being down 0.10% last week. And the Dow Jones Industrial Average, which went up faster than the S&P 500 following the election, is coming down at about twice the speed. It was down 0.29% this week. Year to date, which isn't all that long, but it's significant. I mean, we've had this buildup since the end of December on all the wonderful things that are going to happen. And Ed Laughlin was talking about all the wonderful things that are going to happen. So you would think that the stock market would have risen so far this year, hearing about all these wonderful things that are going to happen. However, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up a whopping 0.33% year to date. And the S&P 500 is a little better. It's up 1.45%. So we had this big jump of about 8% right after the election.
Well, the market broke a record yesterday.
It did? What record did it break?
It was the first day that the U.S. stock market has operated under Donald Trump as president. I can make a record for
you. No.
I can do this. This is great.
But it didn't operate all day.
No, it doesn't matter. So
first
Monday,
day under which there was any operating time under
right,
the new
Monday will be another record. Will be the first full day of market operations under Donald Trump.
Well, we
and
hope.
And every day after that is an additional record it will be the second full day and then the third full day. And each of those is a record.
But you can't make a firm forecast because we don't know that Monday the market will be open. We know it's scheduled to be open.
That's true.
There is a consensus among economic advisors that it will be open on Monday.
I am going to make a firm forecast there.
You are?
Yeah. And I could be wrong. That's always there. But I'm pretty firm in my forecast. The thing with forecasters is that they are often wrong but never in doubt. So hopefully I am not very often wrong. And the doubt is probably half and half, maybe a little bit more, maybe a little bit less.
The doubt?
Yeah.
Okay.
Never in doubt. Well, I'm in doubt. I'm doubtful about a lot of things.
Well, there have been occasional days where the market had an unscheduled close, so it might not be open on Monday. If it's not open on Monday, then Monday will not be the first day, the first full day under the
I'm going to make the prediction that it will be.
That it will be. There's a high probability.
I'm making this kind of facetious statement because it seems like with the market or any other statistic having to do with the economy, headlines are constantly touting some record or another, best fill in the blank since fill in the blank, often the second, you know, best day of stocks or whatever since 3 months ago.
Right.
This is funny. And let me right in the middle of all of the stuff that's been going on, there was a period in November. This is something people don't remember because it wasn't that big a deal at the time. But one of the records that got broken in November that was it was big news. People talked about it. It was on TV and in the printed papers and coming out on electrons on your computer. Was the longest consecutive period of days that the market was down since 1980. But it didn't feel like it was that down because it wasn't that down. It didn't drop very much during those days. This is one of those things to warn the listener and everybody else, even if you're not listening, you should be warned. Records and headlines are misleading, extremely so. Benjamin Disraeli said there are three types of lies in order of severity, and I've got to say this, he was a devout Catholic.
Well, he was a devout Jew before he became a devout Catholic.
Right. So,
but he couldn't be prime minister as a Jew, so he suddenly became a Catholic.
Right. So, but to him, the concept of a cardinal sin, one of the sins that would send you straight to hell. That was a
do not pass go, do not collect $200.
A damned sin.
Right.
And so that helps you understand the three types of lies in order of severity: lies, damned lies, and statistics. So statistics can be worse than the thing that sends you to hell.
Yes.
Keep that in mind when newspapers, the editors and publishers and reporters of which rarely understand what they're saying, talk about this record or that record, because I can tell you that any moment is breaking a record because it's the first moment ever that that moment existed.
That's true.
So that's true. Anyway, that was my little blurb about records and so on. In a side note more closely related to what you were saying, the market had a big run-up after the election. And when compared to a lot of other presidents and run-ups in the past, it's about an average run-up. Some run-ups have been down, some were run-downs rather than run-ups, and some were extremely high and some were extremely low. So the idea here is that we can get into a mind frame that the president has something to do with the market very easily, because we can look around and say, what else has changed? Well, there's a new president. That's the biggest thing. The president does have an effect in the market in that he can give or take away confidence in the system. But the reality is that if you look at the leadership of, for instance, Barack Obama, he was not particularly a good leader. He didn't inspire a whole lot of confidence in the great majority of people that invest in the United States. And yet during his 8 years, the market did great. And you can look at that and say, wow, that's an impressive thing. Barack Obama's market history was fantastic, except it's like saying, while you were eating at McDonald's, the market did well. So every time you eat at McDonald's, the market should do well. That's the point. It's we had a told a joke on the way in here that the difference between causation and correlation is very high. And there's a great joke. There's a new study that came out and says that cancer is caused by scientists and rats. Pretty true. The cause and the correlation are very high there, keeping in mind that the market may have movements that aren't predicated on who's sitting in a White House is important. We said it when Barack Obama was president. We have to say it when Donald Trump is president, too. Unless he changes something fundamental to how the market operates, his input is confidence or lack of confidence. Now, he's got on his agenda to make some changes to some things that do impact how the market operates. And that is, we'll wait and see how that acts, because he's got some positives and some negatives.
Yeah, there's first off, there's some news that came out this week. You want to go on? You want to? We can continue on the same subject if you'd like.
Yeah, you mentioned it in the newsletter. And so I was kind of a hopeful segue for you.
Well, one of the things that's really a lot of analysis has gone into the Donald Trump promises and the congressional promises, and the conclusion of the people who've thought about this, and not just us, but other but economists and people who observe this scene quite a lot, is there's a lot of contradictions here, and it'll be really interesting, to say the least, to see how these contradictions play out. There's a lot of things that are very, very clear. One is that small businesses are very optimistic. Small business owners are very optimistic across the country, and I can understand that because we are small business owners, and we understand that the regulatory burden that we have come under in the last several years has been unpleasant, expensive, difficult, and counterproductive, so that we wind up spending a lot of time and a lot of money dealing with regulatory edicts out of Washington, D.C. that are really counterproductive, at least in our business. I don't know who – they're obviously aimed at somebody, but –
And they were originally aimed for the best interest of the public, but the application of the rules has actually gotten in the interfering in the best interest of the public, very, very much so.
I think what happens is what happened during the last 8 years was a lot of there are some people being taken advantage of in this little area right here, or there's a certain number of people being taken advantage of. So we'll make a regulation that covers everybody. And in the process, the side effect of those is really unpleasant and really unhappy. And it's kind of funny. There was one of the things that came up is with the rhetoric, and that's all we've got so far, from both the president and Congress of repealing a lot of the aspects of Dodd-Frank, which was the law that was put into effect to restrict financial and other businesses from taking risks in the bond market and potentially creating another financial collapse like we saw in 2008 and 2009. So the fact that there's a lot of rhetoric about doing away with a lot of the regulatory restrictions that were designed to prevent corporate collapse has caused a pretty esoteric indicator to move, which is what's called the high-yield bond spread. High-yield bonds have come down in interest rate, and what that means is the marketplace is saying corporate collapse is less likely to happen if we get rid of some of those regulations. which is the reverse of what the regulations were intended to create. But what happens in effect is you take a company that's having a difficult time and it needs to go to the high yield bond market. It's like you needing to borrow money on your credit card.
On the highest interest rate credit cards.
So those companies are kind of on the edge, and increasing the regulatory burden increases their expenses, increases the risk of having some federal agency suddenly hit them with a big fine and put them out of business. So basically the probability of corporate collapse is falling with the discussion about removing regulatory strictures that were designed to keep corporations from collapsing.
Okay, here's another example. During from Dodd-Frank and several other bills that have been passed later, the federal government was given, the executive branch of the federal government, was given some flexibility and some guidelines on how, for instance, private mortgage insurance was charged on FHA loans. What does that even mean? I just got into jargon.
That was
there.
Cool. I don't know what you just said, but it's really impressive.
Basically, if you buy a house and you don't put a big down payment down on it, you don't put 20% down, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, FHA, all the big governmental-backed mortgage companies say, well, you better have insurance to cover in case you can't pay because you don't have any skin in the game. Well, one of the last things that the Obama administration did as it was leaving office was to say, we're going to use that flexibility to make it easier for people that are having trouble paying their mortgages to pay it. We're going to remove some of the requirements to have that insurance, because that insurance costs that person money, and they may not be able to pay the mortgage if they have to pay that extra money for insurance. It also puts all of the banks and the people that have invested in the banks and at risk. And if they lose the house for not having insurance, you can see the problem there. So the absolutely the first thing that was done by the Obama administration as soon as it came into office. So this is hilarious. So you'll get this.
This is hilarious?
Hilarious.
Oh, I
H said with an H.
Hilarious. Yeah.
Investopedia is a nice little place you can get a lot of education on investments and
right.
so on. At 11:58 a.m. yesterday, so the day of the inauguration takes place exactly at noon.
Right.
Okay, 11:58, 2 minutes before, there's a headline, FHA cuts premiums for private mortgage insurance. And it goes in and says, hey, if you're planning on taking out a loan from the FHA, your expenses may have just gotten better. Everybody should take advantage of this. That's really not a good thing to hear, by the way, just on the side. It's like it means you don't need to put down a lot of money in a down payment. And if you don't, and if you need insurance now, you don't. Well, then 3 minutes later, a message goes out. So 12:01 p.m. message goes out. Here's the headline. The headline was written after the fact, but the message went out at 11:03. HUD suspends FHA mortgage insurance rate cut an hour after Trump takes office. it was less than an hour. It was 3 minutes
so you
after
could,
he took office.
If you got your mortgage within that hour.
No.
No?
It was retroactive because it doesn't take effect. The cut didn't take effect till January 27th.
Okay.
So it didn't actually happen. But this is the fun thing. The FHA folks, the people that make these loans, have now received a whole set of regulatory documents, big ones, that the government had to race to put together because the Obama administration gave them a deadline 7 days after inauguration to get this rule into effect. So anybody that was making loans for FHA had a ream of paper dropped on their desk and say, read this in the next 2 weeks because we have to do this now. So anybody that actually started reading it now is like, I wasted that time because the ream now gets shredded because it's not real anymore.
Yeah, that's unfortunately, as presidents leave office, this is not uncommon for them to do things like that.
So it is not a seamless transition. It never is a seamless transition, but this is a point to make in that sometimes a law that allows the president to do executive orders, the law was created to prevent loans from failing. The executive order says, hey, we can prevent loans from failing by just lowering the cost to the payer for the loan. Even if the cost part that's being lowered is the part that helps prevent the loss from hurting the people who made the loan.
But that's, frankly, it's silliness. And the reason it's silliness is,
boy, that is that you can capitalize silliness all the way across it.
Interest rates a couple of months ago were in the 3.25 for 30-year mortgages. Fixed rate average was around 3.25 to 3.5.
Right. And now it's right around
4%. 4.1% is the average rate on a 30-year mortgage today. So adding 1% to the mortgage rate raised the cost of the mortgage a whole lot more
than
the cost of insurance.
Than the cost of insurance, yes.
And one of the reasons interest rates are up, is because there's a little bit of inflation back in the system. I mean, it becomes a pretty complex issue. One of the things that happened, and I never thought I would find it being amazing. The average certificate of deposit at a bank in the United States, just regular certificate of deposit, not jumbos, is paying 1.19%. Now, that sounds like a pittance. It is a pittance. But we all, I think, that have looked at those things remember when it was less than 1%. So we're seeing something. Now, if you want to go for 5 years, you want to lock your money up for 5 years, the average bank in the average CD in the United States will pay you 1.79% per year. When you consider that the Consumer Price Index just came in for the entire year of 2016 at 2.1%, that means the cost of everything that people buy, and maybe it's too broad of a brush stroke, but still the cost of everything that people buy during the year 2016 rose 2.1%. And if the bank is offering to pay you 1.79, and that sounds really, really attractive, remember, if inflation does not rise any more than it did, than it has, I mean, if let's just say the Federal Reserve is completely nails it right down, holds it at 2%, you will only be losing 0.2% a year plus taxes.
Right.
And you say, well, it's in my IRA. Well, yeah, but you'll pay taxes when you take it out of the IRA, or somebody else will pay taxes when they take it out of the IRA. So, oddly enough, there's a degree of normalcy there. I like normalcy, and where banks are actually charging you money to keep your money secure in there while they're paying you interest rate.
Right. There's a piece, kind of a move on the same subject with banks and housing and interest rates. The appointment for Treasury Secretary.
What time is that appointment?
It depends on when you're hearing it.
Okay.
The Senate is having a lot of hearing issues right now,
okay.
So they may need some.
They're trying to do a lot of
aids.
Hearing. Have you noticed
they
that?
They have a lot of aides in there. Are they hearing aides? That's the question. I have that question. It's a valid question.
I think each congressman and senator has multiple hearing aides. Which means they're pretty deaf. If you try to talk to them, they won't listen to you.
That's why they send back those blank emails. When you send them an email, they just send you back boilerplate. Oh, that's not even what I asked a question about.
Right.
So because their hearing aids are functioning somewhere else.
That makes sense.
Okay. So how do you pronounce his name, by the way? It's Munchen?
I think it is Munchen or something.
Munchen
or Munchen. I don't know. I've never seen a pronunciation for his name, and he's always got a smile on his face.
Right, and I hear a lot of people say it different ways. So I'm not sure. I'm going to say Munchen. Okay. Munchen?
Isn't that something out of The Wizard of Oz?
I may be putting the N sound in the right. It could be the Munchkins are different. Anyway.
It could be, right.
He's the pick for Treasury Secretary. He's been going through his Senate hearings and he looks fairly well qualified, which is, there are people that would go either way on that. But he's got some banking experience, which is important, I believe, in the Treasury Secretary. I realize there are a lot of people out there that think there's too many banking people in the cabinet appointments right now.
Too many people in there that know in finance something about finance.
Right.
They should not be appointed because we only need people in there who know nothing and have no experience.
Exactly.
In finance.
Exactly. And so he was asked a lot of questions about foreclosures and you know, his participation in companies that he owned or managed in foreclosures of loans. And you know, there are a lot of issues that I think are appropriate, but that's not one of them. If you give somebody a loan and they don't pay you, you need your money back. You got to get it back somehow. And if they bought something with a loan and they use that thing that they bought as collateral, well, then you can take that thing. That's kind of the basis of our whole system. Now, bankruptcy is a real thing. Ed talks about that during his program. It's one of the strengths of our system, so that if you mess up, if you fall behind, you have some ability to alleviate the debts that you've gained.
Mm-hmm.
But there are people who are serial bad debt folks. Bankers shouldn't be giving them loans, but in this case, a lot of bad loans were made during the Great Recession. Boy, is that an understatement.
A lot of bad loans were made prior to the Great Recession.
Right, prior to the Great Recession.
And they were not paid as things didn't work out.
Right. So saying that, there are some things that we all decided during the Great Recession. Those of you that are listening, remember this clearly. Too big to fail was a big thing that was said a lot. It may have been the biggest statement. Maybe the statement was too big to fail. Anyway, too big to fail was used regularly. All these banks that are making all these loans, that when the loans are failing, the government can't allow these banks to fail because they're too big. They would take down huge sectors of the economy.
And it would actually ultimately wind up costing the United States government more to let them fail than it would be to bail, than it would to bail them out.
Correct. So this concept of, okay, the first step in all of this, this was bipartisan. The Republicans and the Democrats got together and said, how do
you
we solve this?
No, no, they got in bed together.
They got in bed together, and they said, how do we solve this? Okay, first step, we got to prevent these banks from failing. They're too big. Second step, we've got to break up the big banks so they're not too big anymore.
Nah, that won't work.
The problem is we never got to the second step.
Yeah, but it doesn't work because we're competing with big banks elsewhere.
Well, this is the point. The two biggest home loan banks are now completely run by the government.
Mm-hmm.
Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac are private institutions for profit that are being run by the U.S. government. And during Munchen's hearing, I'm sure I'm mangling his name, during his hearing, he said some things about how they should be released back to the public. And he said he doesn't believe, and I'll explain this in a minute, so he doesn't believe in recap and release. Boy, does that sound like a hunting term?
Yeah, I like that.
The capture and release, it's not capture, it's capitalization. Basically, there was a plan by some of the larger shareholders of those two big, big companies saying what the government needs to do is fund the company with a whole bunch of money and then release it back to the private shareholders.
It's Mnuchin.
Mnuchin?
Mnuchin.
But I have heard his name pronounced probably five different ways.
Well, the New York Times apparently is the authoritative source because that
they're very authoritative. I don't know if they, how correct they are, but they're very authoritative.
The name pronunciation has definitely been befuddling, but apparently he pronounces it Mnuchin.
Okay, then I'll get used to pronouncing it Mnuchin.
Mnuchin, like minutia.
Right, Mnuchin. So Mnuchin, in saying that, is saying that the government should release these two banks back to the private without recapitalizing them, without putting a bunch of new assets and money into them, which is a problem for the shareholders of those companies because a lot of the people that own those companies today are not the same people that owned them when they went into failure. They've been purchased since then with this thought that if the government's running them, then the government's going to give them a bunch of money.
Well, my experience in there is very simple. By the way, I happen to agree with him.
I do too, very much so.
And the point is that when a non-governmental organization is run by the government, partially.
That's bad news. That's what China does with its banks.
And that's what the Postal Service does and is gradually going out of business.
In Amtrak. Other words, yeah, it's not a good thing for the management of a business.
You know, and it is a yeah, we'd love to see passenger trains continue.
Right. Wouldn't
and
it
they
be nice?
Have, by the way, they have areas where they're very profitable and areas where they aren't.
Right. And I've got to tell you, I'm prejudiced here. My wife is a huge proponent of Amtrak. She thinks it's fantastic. I have to agree that riding in trains is fun. The fact that the average on-time lateness is 2 hours. Two hours late. That's the average.
But only in if you go on the East Coast, the Acela,
yeah, it's much better.
Is just good for everybody. And but the one that runs across the country that it stops at every little podunk, it stops at Temple.
That's not podunk.
From the sense of a passenger train,
isn't podunk in Kansas or something?
No, podunk is a suburb of Temple, I think. Where the train station is.
Well, and at I'm least not Temple has a suburb.
Yes, and I'm not trying to knock Temple. I'm simply saying that from the perspective of trying to get from one place to another quickly, stopping an entire train for a while in a relatively small place like Temple is counterproductive.
Yeah. So the concept of a government-run for-profit institution is a concept of failure. And you can look at that repeatedly throughout history. You can look at it in China right now because governments are not run to be profitable. They're run on a mandate of the people, whatever that mandate might be. The people might be Kim Jong-un.
No, that's in North Korea.
Right. But
let me defend the Chinese system. The Chinese system doesn't have a private organization, a private bank that's being run by the government.
It's just
they belong to the government.
They're all state banks.
It's like the Treasury Department belongs to the United States government. It's
right.
Not like and
totally understand.
Frankly, one of the news stories of this week is the Chinese turned in their fourth quarter gross domestic product, which amazingly enough this year has matched the external measures that private firms do.
Right, which is, as far as I know, that's an anomaly. I've never seen that happen before, where both the private sector and the government of China are agreeing on their numbers.
But all year, their gross domestic product, the first quarter was 6.6, second quarter 6.6, third quarter 6.6, fourth quarter 6.7. And they did that because they do own the banks lock, stock, and barrel. And they are centrally managing their economy with some free enterprise in it. But the way they do it...
Wait, here's an important piece. If any of those banks, or not any, I shouldn't say any, there are a few of them that aren't in this category.
Right.
But the vast majority of those banks, if they were placed into the United States as if they were an American bank...
Mm-hmm.
They would be shut down immediately.
So would the Treasury Department.
Well, that's true, but that's their whole banking system over there.
Right, but
we have stress tests over here. They can't take any stress over there.
Well, yeah, they can, because the government has the ability over there to manufacture as much money as it wants to fill up the banks. And this is my point. Let me get to this point here. The yuan, renminbi, whatever you want to call it, I mean, they're both accurate,
correct
names. It's like dollar and U.S. money. Cannot be used outside of China. It isn't a world currency. So the Chinese have complete control over it. The markets don't. The markets have some control over it. But basically, because it's strictly an internal currency, they can cushion blows and have done, you know, they've done, I think, a superb job of keeping their economy afloat with minimal disruption and minimal unemployment. Now, whether this will work out over the long term is an open question. It's got a lot of people concerned about it.
There's something, I got to throw this in there. The renminbi was placed in the IMF and World Bank basket of currencies for international exchange. So you can use them elsewhere. Just Chinese people can't use them elsewhere.
Yeah, they basically don't allow them to be exported from the country. And they use dollars. If they have to buy something outside of China, they use dollars. Which, by the way, kind of defeats the argument that they're manipulating their currency to make it artificially low. Because if they make it artificially low against the dollar, that means they're – and they are net importers right now.
Right.
When they go to buy raw materials and so on, it becomes more expensive. The Chinese government, by the way, has fought very, very hard to keep the value of the renminbi higher, not lower, unsuccessfully. And one of the reasons it's unsuccessful is, you know, they've said you can't export the currency. Well, guess what? A lot of Chinese billionaires have been doing things like
buying bitcoins or buying lots of aluminum.
Well, actually, they make aluminum overseas.
Right.
Or they have a subsidiary subsidiary overseas purchase the aluminum from their Chinese company.
Or they have a subsidiary of their company. They own this subsidiary, buy something from another company of theirs,
and then
sue them and lose the suit intentionally to move the money to the other company.
Well, what's happening in China right now, by the way, and I think this is one of the more fascinating things, is they're having to gradually liquidate treasury securities while at the same time they're buying treasury securities. Go figure on that one. From us. They're having to gradually liquidate treasury securities because of exactly what you're talking about. If let's say, a subordinate of Gongsu – I just made that up – Industries in the United States sues Gongsu and Gongsu loses –
Gongsu's gone, been sued.
Yes. Okay. Gongsu loses the court battle and has to pay in dollars to the subsidiary in the United States, which is a tactic they're using. The Chinese government, in essence, has to cough up some dollars for Gongsu to convert – it converts its renminbi into dollars in China and then sends the dollars to the United States. There's a lot of that going on. And which, by the way, anybody that thinks the Chinese economy is, despite the fact it has a high growth rate, he's going to run over us or catch up with us or do something. If you look at the really smart money in China, which are the billionaires, you'll notice that they're doing everything possible to get their money out of China and into the United States.
Okay. And just to throw this in as support for what you just said, that basket of currencies that the IMF looks at, the International Monetary Fund, and they're basically saying they're the regulators of international trade where possible. That basket. You know, there was a bunch of news when the yuan, the renminbi, was added to.
I want to find that basket, by the way.
It's a very nice basket full of money somewhere.
It's at the end of the rainbow.
I think so. Anyway, it was a lot of news, and people were rabble-rousing about how it was diluting the dollar as the international currency. Do you know, as a percentage of all of the money out there, and the IMF is trying to keep that basket relative to money in the exchanges out there.
Mm-hmm.
How much the dollar is as a percentage?
Tell me.
58%.
Right. 58
of all the money in the world.
Is dollars.
Which,
by the way, as a side, this is, I don't know, I think Jake agrees with me. This is Jeff. But this is the reason I have concluded that our negative trade balance, which is relatively huge, every year for the last 40 years or so, has not damaged our economy. We have the fastest growing, healthiest economy in absolute terms in the world. And we've continued to be the leader in world stability in our economy while having this huge trade deficit that everything in economics said should destroy your economy.
Except that we're exporting dollars.
Yes, we have a manufactured product in the United States that we back and we have a warranty on it. Now, if you lose it, I'm sorry.
Yeah,
you don't get it back. But as far as its functional value is concerned, it's backed by the full faith and confidence of the United States Federal Reserve Board, and which is our warranty board in essence. And what we've done is by maintaining a stable dollar in the United States, we create a currency that the entire world can use in the same way. The last time, by the way, this happened was the Roman Empire. The denarius was the world currency. There were other currencies out there, lots of other currencies out there, but people didn't trust them, particularly for international trade. They trusted the denarius. And so the world trusted the dollar today. But we are supposed to actually
play some commercials.
Commercials,
yeah,
so that KTM can stay on the air.
We are capitalist swine around here.
Yes,
you know,
we're capitalist tools.
Really do not like us for that, but hey, we're richer than they are.
Yes.
So, we'll be back after these commercials. If you'd like to join in our craziness, our conversation about things that most people aren't that interested in, though whoever you are listening, you're interested in it. If you'd like to join us, the phone number in here is 254-773-1400. We'll be back on the other side with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. Again, the number in here is 254-773-1400.
We'll be back.
And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And if the last few minutes are here, I want to moderate a little bit from Ed's comments last hour.
Well, look, before you do that, you should know that we have a lot of listeners that do not listen to KTEM. They're listening to podcasts.
Yeah, well, I will do that. But I just want to say that last hour, Ed, who's in the Ask a Lawyer, who runs the Ask a Lawyer program, was very, very enthusiastic about Donald Trump's presidency and all the changes that are going to happen. And I really appreciate his enthusiasm, and I really appreciate the potential for a lot of good things happening, and I'm looking forward to it. But I want to point something out. There are some fundamental contradictions in the policies that are being espoused by the Republicans in Congress right now and by President Trump.
Yeah.
And we got to work through those contradictions, and it's going to be bumpy. And that's, by the way, why the stock market has not risen significantly this year, is because everybody got excited about all the economic things that President Trump was going to do. And the fact that he got elected based on that. And there's been a lot of patient waiting. And every time he speaks, the market goes down just a little bit. And the reason is he doesn't say how he's going to do these things. Because there's some – let me tell you, you want to say something.
Yeah, I want to throw in here, and this is a good reference point for the conservatives listening that hear this and say, what are you talking about? You're just raining on our parade.
Yeah.
I like
your parade.
Yeah, if you think back to the first term of the Obama administration, if you remember the political rhetoric in that campaign, yes, we can, and change, and
no one's going to lose their health insurance.
Right.
But people did.
Right. And what happened during the Obama administration, it's harder to see because he gained popularity right at the end. But for a long period of time, people lost faith. His followers, not the folks that never had faith with him, they didn't lose faith at all, but his followers were extremely discouraged. They were upset. They were sad. They felt like the promises they were given were not lived up to. The same thing is quite possible to happen again. If you feel like everything is going to change immediately, you're going to get discouraged, because we have a system that takes time to change, and it doesn't go through the president's office until the
end.
Policy is already finished, and he doesn't have a whole lot of nuance control there. It's just sign it or don't sign it. He has some ability to say, this is what I want, to Congress, but Congress is not controlled by the president. Obama found that out to his peril. He was an outsider too. He was an outsider from the other side. And he came in and thought, I'm somebody new. I'm going to come drain the swamp. I'm going to shake things up. I'm going to step in and I'm going to change things immediately. And it didn't happen that way. Even the things that he ran on when he was against Hillary Clinton in his first term, the things that he talked about for his healthcare reform in the debates, Obamacare sure looked a lot more like Hillary Care if you look at the debate commentary about between Hillary and Barack. There was the two plans. One, the individual mandate, which is one of the premises of Obamacare, was something that he actively debated against in his president's run-up. So realize that things are going to change. And if you want to keep the momentum that you're feeling right now, and I'm specifically speaking to the conservatives that have a lot of hope, if you want to keep that momentum, be realistic as well. Because there are going to be defeats. And when they happen, you can either completely lose faith, completely lose hope, say, I'm not getting what I wanted, or you keep pushing for it. And the same, I could say the same thing to the Democrats. It's universal. Anyway, and back to you on the next step.
There's some fundamental contradictions. And I mentioned this in the, or we mentioned this in the newsletter this week. And that is, if you're going to cut, if you're going to kill Obamacare, which I really think is going to happen, Obamacare is a net positive for revenue to the government.
Correct.
And there are about 22 million, somewhere between 18 and 22 million, depending on what figure I read, people who are covered under Obamacare who would be instantly without health insurance if Obamacare was repealed.
We wouldn't see much of it in the United in Texas, though. It's
well, we would. We'd see some in Texas, but
not,
we would
not
see,
anywhere near the, right, the impact.
But we would see across the country, and that is that's a lot of people. And not only is it a lot of people, it's a huge impact on the medical system. If you were to suddenly remove the insurance for that 18 to 22 million people, and they show up in the emergency room. The rest of us have to pay for that, and they would cause an instant. I mean,
by the rest of us have to pay for it. Next time you show up at the hospital, your price is going to be high, yeah, because somebody else didn't pay their bill.
And so it would cause an immediate, dramatic increase in insurance premiums. And it really boils down to something very simple: the United States government and the states are shouldering a tremendous amount of the health care costs that previously was being dumped on other people who went to the hospital. Now, we got to figure out how to do that. And the thing that's floating around in Congress is a high-risk healthcare pool for people to get health insurance in outside of Obamacare. Well,
the thing with that, though,
you got to pay for it.
It's extremely expensive, as it should be. It's called high risk.
But in order to make the high risk something like that work, the federal government's going to have to pay for it, in essence.
Right, right.
And that's very expensive. Now, you go turn around and look at the fact that we're going to, okay, let's remove the Obamacare tax. That's one of the prime things that everybody wants to do. It's about 4% on a lot of people. Okay, what are we going to use to replace that income with? And the answer is nobody's come up with one. Well, we're going to cut corporate taxes, which, by the way, is tremendously stimulative.
Particularly at the front end, if there's a repatriation,
right,
where money can come back with a smaller corporate tax on it. But
we got a deficit, and the deficit rose this year to about $500 billion. You cut a tax without either increasing taxes someplace else or cutting spending dramatically. You've got a choice. You can either cut taxes, you can either raise taxes, cut spending, or borrow a bunch of money. And this is the point. Where are we going to cut spending? Well, the only place we could cut enough spending to offset the cuts in taxes that Congress and the president have promised would be either cut Social Security, cut Medicare,
or cut defense.
Or cut defense. And the president has said Medicare and Social Security are off limits.
And defense is off limits.
And we're going to raise defense spending. So the probability is
this is when we say there's conflicts.
The probability is Congress is going to say, let's just borrow a whole bunch more money, because if we cut these taxes, the economy will pick up and we'll gain more revenue at some point in the future. And whether or not that will fly in Congress with the Republican Party that recently shut down the government, or tried to shut down the government on a couple of occasions to reduce borrowing.
Let me add this piece.
That's just a big question. They've got to work this out somehow.
Right. There's a big piece of realism that has to be thrown into the middle of the political world, because rhetoric gets thrown back and forth. But the reality is, if you're working on a home budget and talking back and forth with your spouse, if your mortgage payment and your car payment and or two car payments is already exactly what you make in income, anything else you spend is going to be debt.
Right. You've got to have to charge it on your credit card.
So let's look at the government budget. Defense, Medicare, Social Security, and the other entitlement programs that are the retirements for civil service and defense. That's more than the revenue that's made in taxes. Right. Any other spending is borrowed. So when we're talking about Medicare, if you looked at it in round numbers, Medicare is the thing that's leaking over the top. And I was just the last one I threw in there. So any other medical expenses that are added onto this means more borrowing.
Yeah, paying the people who actually work for the federal government.
Right. That's borrowed.
And
working on roads, that's borrowed.
Right.
The FBI, borrowed. Basically, if you think
air traffic control system,
borrowed. Everything that we do other than those three major programs is borrowed. So we either have to increase our revenue. Well, people don't want the taxes raised. Okay, if we lower regulation, will people be able to make more money and thus be able to pay more taxes? Probably.
At a lower rate.
Probably also. So what we're looking at here is the reality of the budget is not being changed at the moment. We're talking about how the revenue comes in. Let's lower the revenue stream coming in and increase spending in a whole series of areas. I spoke about this when you were out several episodes, just to let you know that reality still exists. And if we ignore it based on rhetoric, it's at our own peril.
Don't forget the additional expenses, and we're out of time.
Right.
Don't forget the additional expenses that are thrown in because of the increased border security. But we'll come back to that next hour.
Yes. So if you'd like to contact us off the air, we do give investment advice to high net worth people. We've got a toll-free number, 1-800-914-7526, or locally, 254-947-1111. You can email us directly, jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com, or you can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com. Until next hour, this has been The Personal Wealth Coach.
News Radio 1400 KTEM. KTEM. Serving Central Texas. KTEM AM. Temple, Belton, Killeen, Fort Hood.